Sure, Alex, she said, and she smiled. Peter had taken to wandering his own home like a ghost. He was grounded, which had something to do with the fact that Josie didn't come over anymore, even though they used to see each other after school 3 or 4 times a week. Joey didn't want to play with him. He was always off at soccer practice or playing a computer game where you had to drive really fast around a racetrack that was bent like a paperclip, which meant that Peter, officially, had nothing to do. One evening after dinner, he heard rustling in the basement. He hadn't been down there since his mother had found him with Josie and the gun, but now he was drawn like a moth to the light over his father's workbench. His father sat on a stool in front of it, holding the very gun that had gotten Peter into so much trouble. "Aren't you supposed to be getting ready for bed?" his father asked. "I'm not tired." He watched his father's hands run down the swan neck of the rifle. "Pretty, isn't it? It's a Remington 721, a .30-06. Peter's father turned to him. "Want to help me clean it?" Peter instinctively glanced toward the stairs, where his mother was washing dishes from dinner. "The way I figure it, Peter, if you're so interested in guns, you need to learn how to respect them. Better safe than sorry, right? Even your mom can't argue with that." He cradled the gun in his lap. "A gun is a very, very dangerous thing. But what makes it so dangerous is that most people don't really understand how it works. And once you do, it's just a tool, like a hammer or a screwdriver. And it doesn't do anything unless you know how to pick it up and use it correctly. You understand?" Peter didn't, but he wasn't about to tell his father. He was about to learn how to use a real rifle. None of those idiot kids in his class, the ones who were such jerks, could say that. "First thing we have to do is open the bolt, like this, to make sure there aren't any bullets in it. Look in the magazine, right down there. See any?" Peter shook his head. "Now, check again. You can never check too many times. Now, there's a little button under the receiver, just in front of the trigger guard. Push that, and you can remove the bolt completely." Peter watched his father take off the big silver ratchet that attached the butt of the rifle to the barrel, just like that. He reached onto his workbench for a bottle of solvent. "Hoppy's number 9," Peter read, and spilled a little bit on a rag. "There's nothing like hunting, Peter," his father said. "To be out in the woods when the rest of the world is still sleeping. To see that deer raise its head and stare right at you." He held the rag away from him. The smell made Peter's head swim, and started to rub the bolt with it. "Here," Peter's father said. "Why don't you do this?" Peter's jaw dropped. He was being told to hold the rifle, after what had happened with Josie? Maybe it was because his father was here to supervise, or maybe this was a trick, and he was going to get punished for wanting to hold it again. Tentative, he reached for it, surprised, as he had been before, at how incredibly heavy it was. On Joey's computer game, Big Buck Hunter, the characters swung their rifles around as if they were feather light. It wasn't a trick. His father wanted him to help, for real. Peter watched him reach for another tin, gun oil, and dribble some onto a clean rag. "We wipe down the bolt and put a drop on the firing pin. You want to know how a gun works, Peter? Come over here." He pointed out the firing pin, a teensy circle inside the circle of the bolt. "Inside the bolt, where you can't see it, there's a big spring. When you pull the trigger, it releases the spring, which hits this firing pin and pushes it out just the tiniest bit." He held his thumb and forefinger apart just a fraction of an inch for illustration. "That firing pin hits the center of a brass bullet and dents a little silver button called the primer. The dent sets off the charge, which is gunpowder inside the brass casing. You've seen a bullet, how it gets thinner and thinner at the end. That skinny part holds the actual bullet, and when the gunpowder goes off, it creates pressure behind the bullet and pushes it from behind. Peter's father took the bolt out of his hands, wiped it with oil, and set it aside. Now, look into the barrel. He pointed the gun as if he were going to shoot at a light bulb on the ceiling. What do you see? Peter peeked into the open barrel from behind. It's like the noodles Mom makes for lunch. Yeah, I guess it is. Rotini? Is that what they're called? The twists in the barrel are like a screw. As the bullet gets pushed out, these grooves make the bullet turn. Kind of like when you throw a football and put some spin on it. Peter had tried to do that in the backyard with his father and Joey, but his hand was too small, or the football was too big, and when he tried to make a pass, mostly it just crashed at his own feet. If the bullet comes out spinning, it can fly straight without wobbling. His father began to fiddle with a long rod that had a loop of wire on the end. Sticking a patch into the loop, he dipped it in solvent. The gunpowder leaves gunk inside the barrel, though, he said, and that's what we have to clean off. Peter watched his father jam the rod into the barrel, up and down, like he was churning butter. He put on a clean patch and ran it through the barrel again, and then another, until they didn't come out streaked black anymore. When I was your age, my father showed me how to do this, too. He threw the patch out in the trash. One day, you and I will go hunting. Peter couldn't contain himself at the very thought of this. He, who couldn't throw a football or dribble a soccer ball or even swim very well, was going to go hunting with his father? He loved the thought of leaving Joey at home. He wondered how long he'd have to wait for this outing, how it would feel to be doing something with his father that was just theirs. Ah, his father said. Now, look down the barrel again. Peter grabbed the gun backward, looking down through the muzzle, the barrel of the gun pressed up against his face near his eye. Jesus, Peter! His father said, taking it out of his hands. Not like that! You've got it backward! He turned the gun so that the barrel was facing away from Peter. Even though the bolt's way over there, and it's safe, you don't ever look down the muzzle of a rifle. You don't point a gun at something you don't want to kill. Peter squinted, looking into the barrel the right way. It was blinding, silver, shiny. Perfect. His father rubbed down the outside of the barrel with oil. Now, pull the trigger. Peter stared at him. Even he knew you didn't do that. It's safe, his father repeated. It's what we need to do to reassemble the gun. Peter hesitantly curled his finger around the half moon of metal and pulled. It released a catch so that the bolt his father was holding slid into place. He watched his father take the rifle back to the gun cabinet. People who get upset about guns don't know them, his father said. If you know them, you can handle them safely. Peter watched his father lock up the gun case. He understood what his father was trying to say. The mystery of the rifle, the very thing that had sparked him to steal the key to the cabinet from his father's underwear drawer and show Josie, was no longer quite as compelling. Now that he'd seen it taken apart and put back together, he saw the firearm for what it was, a collection of fitted metal, the sum of its parts. A gun was nothing, really, without a person behind it. To anyone who cares, whether or not you believe in fate comes down to one thing, who you blame when something goes wrong. Do you think it's your fault, that if you'd tried better or worked harder, it wouldn't have happened? Or do you just chalk it up to circumstance? I know people who will hear about the people who died and will say it was God's will. I know people who will say it was bad luck. And then there's my personal favorite. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Then again, you could say the same thing about me, couldn't you? The day after. For Peter's sixth Christmas, he'd been given a fish. It was one of those Japanese fighting fish, a betta, with a shredded, tissue-thin tail that trailed like the gown of a movie star. Peter named it Wolverine and spent hours staring at its moonbeam scales, its sequin eye. But after a few days, he started to imagine what it would be like to have only a bowl to explore. He wondered if the fish hovered over the tendril of plastic plant each time it passed because there was something new and amazing he'd discovered about its shape and size, or because it was a way to count another lap. Peter started waking up in the middle of the night to see if his fish ever slept, but no matter what time it was, Wolverine was swimming. He thought about what the fish saw, a magnified eyeball rising like a sun through the thick glass bowl. He'd listened to Pastor Ron at church talking about God seeing everything, and he wondered if that was what he was to Wolverine. As he sat in a cell at the Grafton County Jail, Peter tried to remember what had happened to his fish. It died, he supposed. He'd probably watched it to death. He stared up at the camera in the corner of the cell, which blinked at him impassively. They, whoever they were, wanted to make sure he didn't kill himself before he was publicly crucified. To this end, his cell didn't have a cot or a pillow or even a mat, just a hard bench and that stupid camera. Then again, maybe this was a good thing. As far as he could tell, he was alone in this little pod of single cells. He'd been terrified when the sheriff's car pulled up in front of the jail. He'd watched all the TV shows. He knew what happened in places like this. The whole time he was being processed, Peter had kept his mouth shut, not because he was so tough, but because he was afraid that if he opened it, he would start to cry and not remember how to stop. There was the sword fight sound of metal being drawn across metal, and then footsteps. Peter stayed where he was, his hands locked between his knees, his shoulders hunched. He didn't want to look too eager. He didn't want to look pathetic. Invisibility, actually, was something he was pretty good at. He'd perfected it over the past 12 years. A correctional officer stopped in front of his cell. "You've got a visitor," he said, and he opened the door. Peter got up slowly. He looked up at the camera and then followed the officer down a pitted gray hallway. How hard would it be to get out of this jail? What if, like in all the video games, he could do some fancy kung fu move and deck this guard, and another, until he was able to race out the door and suck in the air whose taste he'd already started to forget? What if he had to stay here forever? That was when he remembered what had happened to his fish. In a sweeping moment of animal rights and humanity, Peter had taken Wolverine and flushed him down the toilet. He figured that the plumbing emptied out into some big ocean, like the one his family had gone to last summer on a beach vacation, and that maybe Wolverine could find his way back to Japan and his other beta relatives. It was after Peter confided in his brother that Joey told him about sewers, and that instead of giving his pet freedom, Peter had killed it. The officer stopped in front of a room whose door read, "Private Conference." He couldn't imagine who would visit him, except for his parents, and he didn't want to see them yet. They would ask him questions he couldn't answer, about how you could tuck a son into bed and not recognize him the next morning. Maybe it would be easier to just go back to the camera in his cell, which stared but didn't pass judgment. "Here you go," the officer said, and he opened the door. Peter took a shuddering breath. He wondered what his fish had thought, expecting the cool blue of the sea, only to wind up swimming in shit. Jordan walked into the Grafton County Jail and stopped at the check-in point. He had to sign in before he went to visit Peter Houghton and get a visitor's badge from the correctional officer on the other side of the plexiglass divider. Jordan reached for the clipboard and scrawled his name, then pushed it through the tiny slot at the bottom of the plastic wall. But there was no one there to receive it. The two COs inside were huddled around a small black-and-white TV that was tuned, like every other television on the planet, to a news report about the shooting. "Excuse me," Jordan said, but neither man turned. "When the shooting began," the reporter was saying, "Ed McCabe peered out the door of his ninth-grade math classroom, putting himself between the gunman and his students." The screen cut to a sobbing woman, identified in white block letters below her face as Joan McCabe, sister of victim. "He cared about his kids," she wept. "He cared about them the whole 7 years he taught at Sterling, and he cared about them during the last minute of his life." Jordan shifted his weight. "Hello?" "Just a second, buddy," one correctional officer said, waving an absent hand in his direction. The reporter appeared again on the grainy screen, his hair blowing upward like a boat's sail in the light wind, the monotone brick of the school a wall behind him. "Fellow teachers remember Ed McCabe as a committed teacher who was always willing to go the extra mile to help a student, and as an avid outdoorsman who talked often in the faculty room about his dreams to hike through Alaska. A dream," the reporter said gravely, "that will never come to pass." Jordan took the clipboard and shoved it through the slot in the plexiglass so that it clattered on the floor. Both correctional officers turned at once. "I'm here to see my client," he said. Lewis Houghton had never missed a lecture in the 19 years he'd been a professor at Sterling College, until today. When Lacey had called, he'd left in such a hurry that he hadn't even thought to put a sign on the lecture hall's door. He imagined students waiting for him to appear, waiting to take notes on the very words that came out of his mouth, as if the things he had to say were still beyond reproach. What word, what platitude, what comment of his had led Peter to this? What word, what platitude, what comment might have stopped him? He and Lacey were sitting in their backyard, waiting for the police to leave the house. Well, they had left, or at least one of them, to broaden the search warrant, most likely. Lewis and Lacey hadn't been allowed into their own home for the duration of the search. For a while, they'd stood in the driveway, occasionally watching officers carry out bags and boxes full of things Lewis would have expected, computers, books from Peter's room, and things he hadn't, a tennis racket, a jumbo box of waterproof matches. "What do we do?" Lacey murmured. He shook his head, numb. For one of his journal articles on the value of happiness, he had interviewed elderly folks who were suicidal. "What's left for us?" they'd said. And at the time, Lewis hadn't been able to understand that utter lack of hope. At the time, he couldn't imagine the world going so sour that you couldn't see the way to set it to rights. "There's nothing we can do," Lewis replied, and he meant it. He watched an officer walk out holding a stack of Peter's old comic books. When he'd first come home to find Lacey pacing the driveway, she'd flung herself into his arms. Why? She had sobbed. Why? There were a thousand questions in that one, but Lewis couldn't answer any of them. He'd held on to his wife as if she were driftwood in the middle of this flood, and then he had noticed the eyes of a neighbor across the street, peeking from a drawn curtain. That's when they had moved to the backyard. They sat on the porch swing, surrounded by a thicket of bare branches and melting snow. Lewis sat perfectly still, his fingers and lips numb from cold, from shock. "Do you think," Lacey whispered, "it's our fault?" He stared at her, amazed at her bravery. She'd put into words what he hadn't allowed himself to even think. But what else was left to say between them? The shootings had happened. Their son was involved. You couldn't argue the facts. You could only change the lens through which you looked at them. Lewis bent his head. "I don't know." Where did you even begin to look at those statistics? Had it happened because Lacey had picked Peter up too much as a baby, or because Lewis had pretended to laugh when Peter took a tumble, hoping that the toddler wouldn't cry if he didn't think there was anything to cry about? Should they have monitored more closely what he read, watched, listened to, or would smothering him have led to the same outcome? Or maybe it was the combination of Lacey and Lewis together. If a couple's children counted as a track record, then they had failed miserably. Twice. Lacey stared down at the intricate brickwork between her shoes. Lewis remembered laying this patio. He had leveled the sand and set the brick himself. Peter had wanted to help, but Lewis hadn't let him. The bricks were too heavy. "You could get hurt," he'd said. If Lewis had been less protective, if Peter had felt true pain, might he have been less likely to inflict it? "What was the name of Hitler's mother?" Lacey asked. Lewis blinked at her. "What? Was she awful?" He put his arm around Lacey. "Don't do this to yourself," he murmured. She buried her face in his shoulder. "Everyone else will." For just a moment, Lewis let himself believe that everyone was mistaken, that Peter couldn't have been the shooter today. In a way, this was true, although there had been hundreds of witnesses. The boy they'd seen wasn't the same one Lewis had talked to last night before he went to bed. They'd had a conversation about Peter's car. "You know you have to get it inspected by the end of the month," Lewis had said. "Yeah," Peter had replied. "I already made an appointment." Had he been lying about that, too? "The lawyer, he said he'll call us," Lewis answered. "Did you tell him Peter's allergic to shellfish? If they feed him any..." "I told him," Lewis said, although he hadn't. He pictured Peter sitting alone in a cell at a jail he'd driven by every summer en route to the Haverhill Fairgrounds. He thought of Peter calling home on the second night of sleepaway camp, begging to be picked up. He thought of his son, who was still his son, even if he had done something so horrible that Lewis couldn't close his eyes without imagining the worst, and then his ribs felt too tight and he couldn't draw in enough air. "Lewis," Lacey said, pulling away as he gasped. "Are you all right?" He nodded, smiled, but he was choking on the truth. "Mr. Houghton?" They both glanced up to find a police officer standing in front of them. "Sir, could you come with me for a second?" Lacey stood up beside him, but he held her off with one hand. He didn't know where this cop was taking him, what he was about to be shown. He didn't want Lacey to see it if she didn't have to. He followed the policeman into his own house, arrested for a moment by the white-gloved officers combing through his kitchen, his closet. As soon as they reached the basement door, he started to sweat. He knew where they were headed. It was something he had studiously avoided thinking about since he had first gotten Lacey's call. Another officer was standing in the basement, blocking Lewis's view. It was 10 degrees colder down here, and yet Lewis was sweating. He mopped his forehead with his sleeve. "These rifles," the officer said. "They belong to you?" Lewis swallowed. "Yes. I hunt." "Can you tell us, Mr. Houghton, if all your firearms are here?" The officer stepped aside to reveal the glass-fronted gun cabinet. Lewis felt his knees buckle. 3 of his 5 hunting rifles were nestled inside the gun cabinet like wallflowers at a dance. 2 were missing. Until this moment, he hadn't allowed himself to believe this horrible thing about Peter. Until this moment, it had been a devastating accident. Now, Lewis started blaming himself. He faced the officer, looking the man in the eye without giving any of his feelings away. An expression, Lewis realized, he'd learned from his own son. "No," he said. "They're not." The first unwritten rule of defense law was to act like you knew everything, when in fact you knew absolutely nothing at all. You were facing an unknown client who may or may not have had a chance in hell of acquittal. The trick, however, was to remain simultaneously impassive and impressive. You had to immediately set the parameters of the relationship. "I am boss. You tell me only what I need to hear." Jordan had been in this situation 100 times before, waiting in a private conference room at this very jail for his next meal ticket to arrive. And he truly believed he had seen it all, which is why he was stunned to find that Peter Houghton had the ability to surprise him. Given the magnitude of the shooting and the damage wrought, the terror on the faces Jordan had seen on the television screen, well, this skinny, freckled, four-eyed kid hardly seemed capable of such an act. This was his first thought. His second was, "That'll work to my advantage." "Peter," he said, "I'm Jordan McAfee, and I'm a lawyer. I've been retained by your parents to represent you." He waited for a response. "Have a seat," he said, but the boy remained standing. "Or don't," Jordan added. He put on his business mask and looked up at Peter. "You'll be arraigned tomorrow. You're not going to get bail. We'll have a chance to go over the charges in the morning before you go into court." He gave Peter a moment to digest this information. "From here on in, you're not going through this alone. You've got me." Was it Jordan's imagination, or had something flashed in Peter's eyes when he'd said those words? As quickly as it might have happened, it was gone. Peter stared down at the ground, expressionless. "Well," Jordan said, getting to his feet, "any questions?" As he expected, there wasn't any response. Hell, for all of Peter's involvement in this little discussion, Jordan might as well have been chatting up one of the less fortunate victims of the shooting. "Maybe you are," he thought. And the voice in his head sounded too damn much like his wife's. "All right, then. I'll see you tomorrow." He knocked on the door, summoning the correctional officer who would take Peter back to his cell, when suddenly the boy spoke. "How many did I get?" Jordan hesitated, his hand on the knob. He didn't turn to face his client. "I'll see you tomorrow," he repeated. Dr. Irvin Peabody lived across the river in Norwich, Vermont, and worked part-time at Sterling College's psychology program. 6 years ago, he had been one of 7 co-authors of a published paper about school violence, an academic exercise he barely remembered. And yet, He'd been called by the NBC affiliate out of Burlington, a morning news show he sometimes watched over a bowl of cereal for the sheer glee of seeing how often the inept newscasters screwed up. "We're looking for someone who can talk about the shooting from a psychological standpoint," the producer had said, and Irvin had replied, "I'm your man." "Warning signals," he said in response to the anchor's question. "Well, these young men pull away from others. They tend to be loners. They talk about hurting themselves or others. They can't function in school or are subjected to discipline there. They lack a connection with someone, anyone, who might make them feel important." Irvin knew the network hadn't come to him for his expertise, only for solace. The rest of Sterling, the rest of the world, wanted to know that kids like Peter Houghton were recognizable, as if the potential to turn into a murderer overnight were a visible birthmark. "So there's a general profile of a school shooter," the anchor prodded. Irvin Peabody looked into the camera. He knew the truth, that if you said these kids wore black or listened to odd music or were angry, you were discussing most of the male teenage population at some point during their adolescent years. He knew that if a deeply disturbed individual was intent on doing damage, he'd probably succeed. But he also knew that every eye in the Connecticut Valley was on him, maybe even in the whole Northeast, and that he was up for tenure at Sterling. A little prestige, a label of expert, couldn't hurt. "You could make that argument," he said. Lewis was the one who settled the Houghton household for the night. He'd start in the kitchen and load the dishwasher. He'd lock the front door and turn off the lights. Then he'd head upstairs, where Lacey was usually already in bed reading, if not out assisting at a birth, and he'd stop in his son's room, tell him to shut off the computer and go to bed. Tonight he found himself standing in front of Peter's room, looking at the mess wrought by the police during their search. He thought about writing the remaining books on the shelves, putting away the contents of the desk drawers that had been dumped onto the carpet. On second thought, he gently closed the door. Lacey wasn't in the bedroom or brushing her teeth. He hesitated, an ear cocked. There was chatter. It sounded like a furtive conversation, coming from the room directly below him. He retraced his steps, drawing closer to the voices. Who would Lacey be talking to at nearly midnight? The screen of the television glowed green and unearthly in the dark study. Lewis had forgotten there even was a television in that room. It was so infrequently used. He saw the CNN logo and familiar ticker tape of breaking news along the bottom. A thought occurred to him. That ticker tape hadn't existed until 9/11. Until people were so scared that they needed to know, without any delay, the facts of the world they inhabited. Lacey was kneeling on the carpet, her face turned up to the anchors. "There is little word yet about how the man who was the shooter secured his weapons, or exactly what those weapons are." "Lacey," he said, swallowing. "Lacey, come to bed." Lacey didn't move, didn't give any indication she had heard him. Lewis passed her, trailing his hand over her shoulder as he went to shut off the television. "Preliminary reports are focusing on two pistols," the anchor confided, just before his image disappeared. Lacey turned to him. Her eyes reminded him of the sky you see from airplanes, a boundless gray that could be anywhere and nowhere all at once. "They keep calling him a man," she said. "But he's only a boy." "Lacey," he repeated, and she stood and moved into his arms, as if this were her invitation to the dance. If you listen carefully in a hospital, you can hear the truth. Nurses whisper to one another over your still body when you're pretending to sleep. Policemen trade secrets in the hallway. doctors enter your room with another patient's condition on their lips. Josie had been making a mental list of the wounded. It seemed she could play 6 degrees of separation with any of the injured. When she had seen them last, when they had crossed her path, where they had been in proximity to her when they had been shot. There was Drew Gerard, who'd grabbed Matt and Josie to tell them that Peter Houghton was shooting up the school. Emma, who'd been sitting 3 chairs away from Josie in the cafeteria. And Trey McKenzie, a football player known for his house parties. John Eberhard, who had been eating Josie's French fries that morning. Min Horuka, an exchange student from Tokyo who'd gotten drunk last year out on the ropes course behind the track and then peed into the open window of the principal's car. Natalie Zelenko, who'd been in front of Josie in the cafeteria line. Coach Spears and Miss Rotoli, 2 former teachers of Josie's. Brady Price and Haley Weaver, the golden senior couple. There were others that Josie knew only by name. Michael Beach, Steve Baburius, Natalie Pflug, Austin Prokioff, Elisa Carr, Jared Weiner, Richard Hicks, Jada Knight, Zoe Patterson. Strangers with whom, now, she'd be linked forever. It was harder to find out the names of the dead. They were whispered about even more quietly, as if their condition were contagious to the rest of the unfortunate souls just taking up space in the hospital beds. Josie had heard rumors that Mr. McCabe had been killed and Topher McPhee, the school pot dealer. To hoard crumbs of information, Josie tried to watch television, which was running 24-hour Sterling High shooting coverage, but inevitably her mother would come into the room and turn it off. All she had gleaned from her forbidden media forays was that there had been 10 fatalities. Matt was one. Every time Josie thought about it, something happened to her body. She stopped breathing. All the words she knew congealed at the bottom of her throat, a boulder blocking the exit from a cave. Thanks to the sedatives, so much of this seemed unreal, as if she were walking on the spongy floor of a dream. But the moment she thought of Matt, it became authentic and raw. She would never kiss Matt again. She would never hear him laugh. She would never feel the print of his hand on her waist, or read a note he'd slipped through the furrows of her locker, or feel her heart beat into his hand when he unbuttoned her shirt. She was only remembering the half of it, that she knew, as if the shooting hadn't only split her life into before and after, but also robbed her of certain skills, the ability to last an hour without puddling into tears, the ability to see the color red without feeling queasy, the ability to form a skeleton of the truth from the bare bones of memory. To remember the rest of it, given what had happened, would be nearly obscene. So instead, Josie found herself veering drunkenly from the soft focus moments with Matt to the macabre. She kept thinking of a line from Romeo and Juliet that had freaked her out when they'd studied the play in 9th grade. "With worms that are thy chambermaids." Romeo had said it to Juliet's looks-like-dead body in the Capulet crypt. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. But there were a whole bunch of steps in between that no one ever talked about, and when the nurses were gone in the middle of the night, Josie found herself wondering how long it took for flesh to peel from a skull, what happened to the jelly of eyes, whether Matt had already stopped looking like Matt. And then she'd wake up and find herself screaming with a dozen doctors and nurses holding her down. If you gave someone your heart and they died, did they take it with them? Did you spend the rest of forever with a hole inside you that couldn't be filled? The door to her room opened and her mother stepped inside. "So," she said, with a fake smile so wide it divided her entire head like an equator. "You ready?" It was only 7 a.m., but Josie had already been discharged. She nodded at her mother. Josie sort of hated her right now. She was acting all concerned and worried, but it was too much, too late, as if it had taken this shooting for her to wake up to the fact that she had absolutely no relationship with Josie. She kept telling Josie she was here if Josie needed to talk, which was ridiculous. Even if Josie wanted to, which she didn't, her mother was the last person on earth she'd want to confide in. She wouldn't understand. No one would, except for the other kids lying in different rooms in this hospital. This hadn't been just some murder on the street somewhere, which would have been bad enough. This was the worst that could happen, in a place where Josie would have to return, whether she wanted to or not. Josie was wearing different clothes than the ones she had been brought here with, which had mysteriously disappeared. No one was admitting to anything, but Josie assumed they were covered with Matt's blood. In this, they had been right to throw them away. No matter how much bleach was used and how many washings were done, Josie knew she'd be able to see the stains. Her head still ached from where she'd struck the floor when she fainted. She'd cut her forehead and narrowly avoided needing stitches, although the doctors had wanted to watch her overnight. For what? Josie had wondered. A stroke? A blood clot? Suicide? When Josie stood up, her mother was at her side immediately, an arm anchored around her for support. It reminded Josie of the way that she and Matt sometimes walked down the street in the summer, their hands filed into the back pockets of each other's jeans. "Oh, Josie," her mother said, and that was how she realized she'd started to cry again. It happened so often now that Josie had lost the capacity to tell when it stopped and started. Her mother offered her a tissue. "You know what? You'll start feeling better when you get home. I promise." Well, duh. Josie couldn't start feeling any worse. But she managed a grimace, which might have been a smile if you weren't looking too closely, because she knew that's what her mother needed right now. She walked the 15 steps to the door of her hospital room. "You take care, sweetheart," one of the nurses said as Josie passed their pod of desks. Another one, the one Josie had liked the best, who fed her ice chips, smiled. "Don't come back and see us, you hear?" Josie moved slowly toward the elevator, which seemed to get farther and farther away each time she glanced up. As she passed by one of the patient rooms, she noticed a familiar name on the clipboard outside. Haley Weaver. Haley was a senior, homecoming queen for the past 2 years. She and her boyfriend, Brady, were the Brangelina of Sterling High. Roles Josie actually had believed she and Matt stood a good chance to inherit after Haley and Brady graduated. Even the wishful thinkers who pined after Brady for his smoky smile and sculpted body had to admit that there was a poetic justice to his dating Haley, the most beautiful girl in the school. With her waterfall of white blonde hair and her clear blue eyes, she had always reminded Josie of a magical fairy, the serene, heavenly creature that floats down to grant someone's wishes. There were all sorts of stories that circulated about them, how Brady had given up football scholarships at colleges that didn't have art programs for Haley, how Haley had gotten a tattoo of Brady's initials in a place no one could see, how on their first date he'd had rose petals spread on the passenger seat of his Honda. Josie, circulating in the same crowd as Haley, knew that most of this was bullshit. Haley herself had admitted, first, that it was a temporary tattoo, and second, that it wasn't rose petals, but a bouquet of lilacs he'd stolen from a neighbor's garden.
"Josie?"
Haley whispered now, from inside the room.
"Is that you?"
Josie felt her mother's hand on her arm, restraining her. But then Haley's parents, who were blocking a clear view of the bed, moved away. The right half of Haley's face was swathed in bandages. Her hair was shaved to the scalp above it. Her nose had been broken, and her one visible eye was completely bloodshot. Josie's mother drew in her breath silently. She stepped inside and forced herself to smile.
"Josie,"
Haley said.
"He killed them, Courtney and Maddie, and then he pointed the gun at me, but Brady stepped in front of it."
A tear streaked down the cheek that wasn't bandaged.
"You know how people are always saying they'd do that for you?"
Josie started shaking. She wanted to ask Haley 100 questions, but her teeth were chattering so hard that she couldn't manage a single word. Haley grabbed onto her hand, and Josie startled. She wanted to pull away. She wanted to pretend she'd never seen Haley Weaver like this.
"If I ask you something," Haley said, "you'll be honest, won't you?"
Josie nodded.
"My face,"
she whispered.
"It's ruined, isn't it?"
Josie looked Haley in the eye.
"No,"
she said.
"It's fine."
They both knew she wasn't telling the truth. Josie said goodbye to Haley and her parents, grabbed onto her mother, and hurried even faster toward the elevators, even though every step felt like a thunderstorm behind her eyes. She suddenly remembered studying the brain in science class, how a steel rod had pierced a man's skull and he opened up his mouth to speak Portuguese, a language he'd never studied.
Maybe it would be like this now for Josie.
Maybe her native tongue, from here on in, would be a string of lies. By the time Patrick returned to Sterling High the next morning, the crime scene detectives had turned the halls of the school into an enormous spider web. Based on where the victims had been found, string was taped up. A burst of lines radiating from one spot where Peter Houghton had paused long enough to fire shots before moving on. The lines of string crossed each other at points, a grid of panic, a graph of chaos. He stood for a moment in the center of the commotion, watching the techs weave the string across the hallways and between banks of lockers and into doorways. He imagined what it would have been like to start running at the sound of the gunshots, to feel people pushing behind you like a tide, to know that you couldn't move faster than a speeding bullet, to realize too late you were trapped, a spider's prey. Patrick picked his way through the web, careful not to disturb the work of the techs. He would use what they did to corroborate the stories of the witnesses, all 1,026 of them. The breakfast broadcast of the three local network news stations was devoted to that morning's arraignment of Peter Houghton. Alex stood in front of the television in her bedroom, nursing her cup of coffee and staring at the backdrop behind the eager reporters, her former workplace, the district courthouse. She'd settled Josie in her bedroom to sleep the dark, dreamless sleep of the sedated. To be perfectly honest, Alex needed this time alone, too. Who would have guessed that a woman who'd become a master at putting on a public face would find it so emotionally exhausting to hold herself together in front of her daughter? She wanted to sit down and get drunk. She wanted to weep, her head buried in her hands, at her good fortune. Her daughter was two doors away from her. Later, they would have breakfast together. How many parents in this town were waking up to realize this would never be true again? Alex shut off the television. She didn't want to compromise her objectivity as the future judge on this case by listening to what the media had to say. She knew there would be critics, people who said that because her daughter went to Sterling High School, Alex should be removed from the case. If Josie had been shot, she would have quickly agreed. If Josie had even still been friendly with Peter Houghton, Alex would have recused herself. But as it stood, Alex's judgment was compromised no more than that of any other justice who lived in the area, or who knew a child who attended the school, or who was the parent of a teenager. It happened all the time to North Country justices. Someone you knew would inevitably wind up in your courtroom. When Alex was rotating as a district court judge, she'd faced defendants she'd known on a personal level. Her mailman caught with pot in his car, a domestic disturbance between her mechanic and his wife. As long as the dispute didn't involve Alex personally, it was perfectly legal, in fact, mandatory, for her to try the case. In those scenarios, you simply took yourself out of the equation. You became the judge and nothing more. The shooting, as Alex saw it, was the same set of circumstances, ratcheted up a notch. In fact, she'd argue that in a case with the massive media coverage this one had, it would take someone with a defense background, like Alex's, to truly be impartial to the shooter. And the more she thought about it, the more firmly convinced Alex became that justice couldn't be done without her involvement, the more ludicrous it seemed to suggest she was not the best judge for the job. She took another sip of her coffee and tiptoed from her bedroom to Josie's, but the door stood wide open, and her daughter wasn't inside. "Josie?" Alex called, panicking. "Josie, are you all right?" "Down here," Josie said, and Alex felt the knot inside her unravel again. She walked downstairs to find Josie sitting at the kitchen table. She was dressed in a skirt and tights and a black sweater. Her hair was still damp from a shower, and she had tried to cover the bandage on her forehead with a swath of bangs. She looked up at Alex. "Do I look all right?" "For what?" Alex asked, dumbfounded. She couldn't be expecting to go to school, could she? The doctors had told Alex that Josie might never remember the shooting, but could she erase the fact that it had ever happened from her mind, too? "The arraignment," Josie said. "Sweetheart, there is no way you're going near that courthouse today."
"I have to."
"You're not going," Alex said flatly. Josie looked as if she were unraveling at the seams.
"Why not?"
Alex opened her mouth to answer, but couldn't. This wasn't logic. It was gut instinct. She didn't want her daughter to relive this experience.
"Because I said so," she finally replied. "That's not an answer," Josie accused.
"I know what the media will do if they see you at the courthouse today," Alex said. "I know that nothing's going to happen at that arraignment that's going to be a surprise to anyone, and I know that I don't want to let you out of my sight right now."
"Then come with me."
Alex shook her head.
"I can't, Josie," she said softly. "This is going to be my case."
She watched Josie pale and realized that until that moment, Josie hadn't considered this. The trial, by default, would put an even thicker wall between them. As a judge, there would be information she couldn't share with her daughter, confidences she couldn't keep. While Josie was struggling to move past this tragedy, Alex would be knee-deep in it. Why had she put so much thought into judging this case, and so little into how it would affect her own daughter? Josie didn't give a damn if her mother was a fair judge right now. She only wanted, needed, a mother. And motherhood, unlike the law, was something that had never come easily to Alex. Out of the blue, she thought of Lacey Houghton, a mother who was in a whole different level of hell right now, who would have simply taken Josie's hand and sat with her and somehow made it seem sympathetic instead of contrived. But Alex, who had never been the June Cleaver type, had to reach back years to find some moment of connection, something she and Josie had done once before that might work again now to hold them together.
"Why don't you go upstairs and change, and we'll make pancakes? You used to like that."
"Yeah, when I was 5.
chocolate chip cookies, then.
Josie blinked at Alex.
Are you on crack?
Alex sounded ridiculous even to herself, but she was desperate to show Josie that she could and would take care of her, and that her job came second. She stood up, opening cabinets until she found a Scrabble game.
Well, then, how about this?
Alex said, holding out the box. I bet you can't beat me. Josie pushed past her.
You win,
she said woodenly, and then she walked away. The student who was being interviewed by the CBS affiliate out of Nashua remembered Peter Houghton from a ninth-grade English class.
We had to write a story with a first-person narrator, and we could pick anyone, the boy said. Peter did the voice of John Hinckley. From the things he said, you think he's looking out from hell, but then at the end you find out it's heaven. It freaked out our teacher. She had the principal look at the paper and everything.
The boy hesitated, scratching his thumb along the seam of his jeans. Peter told them it was poetic license and an unreliable narrator, which we'd been studying also. He glanced up at the camera.
I think he got an A.
At the traffic light, Patrick fell asleep. He dreamed that he was running through the halls of the school, hearing gunshots, but every time he turned a corner, he found himself hovering in midair, the floor having vanished beneath his feet. At a honk, he snapped alert. He waved an apology to the car that pulled up alongside him to pass and drove to the state crime lab, where the ballistics tests had been given priority. Like Patrick, these techs had been working around the clock. His favorite and most trusted technician was a woman named Selma Abernathy, a grandmother of four who knew more about cutting-edge technology than any techno-geek. She looked up when Patrick came into the lab and raised a brow.
You've been napping, she accused.
Patrick shook his head.
Scout's honor. You look too good for someone who's exhausted.
He grinned.
Selma, you've really got to get over your crush on me.
She pushed her glasses up on her nose.
Honey, I'm smart enough to fall for someone who doesn't make my life a pain in the ass. You want your results?
Patrick followed her over to a table on which were four guns, two pistols and two sawed-off shotguns. They were tagged. Gun A, Gun B, the two pistols, Gun C and Gun D, the shotguns. He recognized the pistols. They were the ones found in the locker room, one held by Peter Houghton, the other one a short distance away on the tile floor.
First I tested for latent prints, Selma said, and she showed the results to Patrick. Gun A had a print that matches your suspect. Guns C and D were clean. Gun B had a partial print on it that was inconclusive.
Selma nodded to the rear of the laboratory, where enormous barrels of water were used for test-firing the guns. She would have test-fired each weapon into the water, Patrick knew. When a bullet was fired, it spun through the barrel of a gun, which caused striations on the metal. As a result, you could tell, by looking at a bullet, exactly which gun it had been fired from. This would help Patrick piece together Peter Houghton's rampage, where he'd stopped to shoot, which weapon he'd used.
Gun A was the one primarily used during the shooting. Guns C and D were left in the backpack retrieved at the crime scene, which is actually a good thing because they most likely would have done more damage. All of the bullets retrieved from the bodies of victims were fired from Gun A, the first pistol.
Patrick wondered where Peter Houghton had gotten his armory. And at the same time, he realized that it wasn't hard in Sterling to find someone who hunted or went target shooting at the site of an old dump in the woods.
I know from the gunpowder residue that Gun B was fired. However, there hasn't been a bullet recovered yet that confirms this. They're still processing.
Let me finish, Selma said. The other interesting thing about gun B is that it jammed after that one discharge. When we examined it, we found a double feed.